Welcome, everybody. This really is a treat, and it is a treat. It's amazing what Davis people will do to come out early in the morning for some free chocolate. I do appreciate y'all being here, and Rick is our first speaker this year in my class, and some of you know we have some extraordinary people, and Rick and I just recently got acquainted because of working on this new book with Jim Kilts, because Rick worked with Jim for so many years at Kraft and Nabisco, and I'll take a couple of minutes and tell you a little bit about Rick's background, which is extraordinary, but I want to do that quickly because the real fun is going to be getting some interaction, interface with him. This is something we haven't done, made Rick a little nervous, and I said, we have never done this before. So he's just, oh, great, the new guinea pig. But I have it. Normally we'd just have our presenter get up and speak, but we thought it'd be kind of a little different, more fun to do some questions. And if there's questions that you have during the morning, please feel free to ask, or, later on I'll stop, and, something that's pressing on you. Rick is really open to ask any questions. You'll find him just an incredibly personable person. And we were having dinner last night. My daughter Tracy, stand up and say hello. This is my daughter Tracy, who is it's my daughter, who works with Grocery Outlets. We have a couple of guests here, McGregor Reed and Eric Lindberg, who are the co-CEOs of Grocery Outlets, and Tracy works with them, so be nice to them today. She wants a raise. All right, catch my breath so we can get on with this. Rick is, and as a lot of my students know, in terms of our speakers, we get prepared and Google them and find out some things about the company. Rick's had an extraordinary experience. I'll tell you, the best compliment last night was after dinner, my wife Sandy and Tracy and I said, he's just like Bob Eckert. Now, some of you know Bob Eckert, who is the CEO of Mattel, has been here many times to support and help our campus. Rick and Bob are best friends. They started at Kraft on the same day, both went to Northwestern, and have been best friends ever since. So this is even more special to have Rick here. Rick's the chairman and president and chief executive officer of the Hershey Company. So I'm going to read you a couple of things because I think they're very significant and may even help you with some questions. Prior to joining Hershey in March 2001, Rick was president of the Nabisco Biscuit Company, which was also working with Jim Kilts when he was president of Nabisco. Rick was at Kraft for 18 years, rose from going in and sales, marketing, to become a senior executive in those divisions. He was group vice president of Kraft, and then when he left Kraft after 18 years, went with Jim Kilts to Nabisco, became president of the biscuit division. Rick, is that my right about that? He was also president of Pillsbury, North America. So at a very young age, Rick's had some pretty extraordinary experiences. He's a graduate of Northwestern. Why didn't you come here? Which is the Kellogg School of graduate of with honors. Went to Georgia State University and was magna cum laude. He's on the board of directors of McDonald's, and I can go on with a number of other directors he's on. He's the chairman of the board of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is the most prestigious food group in the United States. My gosh, on the board of the Hershey Trust, written up in numerous magazines. The one that was most significant to me is I was on a plane it's 2005 when that happened. He was named by Barron's as one of the the top most respected CEOs in the country by Barron's Magazine. So, Rick comes with all the credentials and all the experience. But I think the most significant thing, as we again saw at dinner last night, Rick's really a neat guy. He's a really neat human being. He's a dad. He's an 11-year-old daughter, Sarah. His wife, Susan, is, just they've been together a long time. And he lives in, are you ready? Lititz. How'd I do? Lititz, Pennsylvania. You can tell him what Bob Eckert calls it. I'll call it Lititz, Pennsylvania, which is a small town in central Pennsylvania. So if you wouldn't mind, please welcome a good friend and someone who's really giving to our school, Mr. Rick Lunny. Just a little bit about you, what you're most excited about these days, and we'll go from there.
First off, that was almost a eulogy. Fortunately, I'm still taking oxygen, so I'm still here. So I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you very much. Bob and I go way back. We first met. He said he got acquainted. I hope he said reacquainted. Bob and I first met, must have been in the mid to late. Yes. Are you going to finish all my sentences?
I'm sorry. I told you this is new
Tracy,
for me.
Does he do this at home? Is that it? Yeah, so. No wonder your mom's not here. In the late 80s, and seriously, Bob was is energetic and intense in the right way, and is focused on understanding what your problems are, what your issues are, how to do things better. And that's why when you hear about all that he had done with his introduction and has done,
Thanks. It
just has continued through all these years. So you're all very fortunate, and certainly UC Davis is very fortunate to have someone of Bob Lorber here. So you should feel very, very good about that. That's why I'm here. And Bob and I were talking on the phone for this book about Jim Kilts. And let me digress for a minute. And I look around. There's a few students here. There's a few old people like myself. And the question I'm asked the most often is, do you have a mentor? Talk about a mentor. And I think the days have changed somewhat where there's a pure mentor-mentee relationship where you say, okay, you're my mentor, and I'm going to meet with you once a month on these issues. You will find different mentors for different situations. And you'll find that one will find a couple of people that will stay with you, or you'll stay with them for your entire career, most of it. And Jim Kilts is one of those. While I've worked for Jim Kilts three different times over the past 20 years, we are very, very good friends. And the most important thing is we know where the friendship has to kind of like stop on Monday morning but can resume on Friday evening. And so my only advice, particularly to the students, is to find a couple of those people. And the most important thing is don't find someone like you. The worst thing you can do is find someone in a mentor relationship that you want to be a mirror image of you, because then it's like, well, A, I'm not going to learn anything differently. B, I'm never going to get the high hard ones. And whether we like it or not, we all want to get the high hard ones of what we're doing or not doing. And so that's really just a little bit of a perspective on what's been a major benefit and driving force for me, close to 30 years in my career, is in all the things that Bob read about me. While they're factually correct, what's not mentioned in any of those are all the people who helped me, and therefore all of you who have done well, all the people who have helped you along the way. And this is very much a team sport. So there's an old expression, and I just thought of it as Bob was up there talking. It's an Indian expression, loosely translated, goes something such as this: I have to do it myself, but I can't do it alone. And if you think about that, that's a very good way to think about how you can matriculate. It's an academic word, but I'll use that here. Work your way through your career. So,
Rick, tell us a little bit about the Hershey Company and how you came there.
Yeah. I want you to first, a couple of things. Bob and I aren't going to be on the UC Davis basketball team. So for those of you in the back, if you have trouble, you can stand up from time to time and check us out.
I tried.
That's one. Yeah, all right. The second one is, Bob has the questions. We had dinner last night. I didn't get any of the questions. So
my first question
is tell you about the
Hershey Company and how right. you got there. And
all right. Hershey Company is interesting. It's now about 114 years old. When I joined it as chairman and CEO in 2001, I was the first outsider, almost in the history of the company, but no, I was the first outsider in terms of the CEO, and I was either the eighth or the ninth CEO. So here I was coming in from outside of the company to, you know, the top position, and I don't say that with any hubris. That's just CEO's a top position. So you really have to just start to meet the senior executives there, help them understand what you're bringing, why the board chose to go outside. But what's interesting, when a new CEO is appointed, a couple of things happen. He's appointed by a board who's pretty much set in terms of their view of the company. He's coming into a company where the senior executive team is pretty much set with the strategy of the company. Yet, when one is brought in from the outside, you're brought in for an obvious reason, and that's to change the future course of the company. So it was very interesting coming in from the outside. And this is one of those instances where having worked at a couple of other different companies is very beneficial when you go in at the CEO. And the problem with going as a CEO, all of you think it's a good idea, you all want to be a CEO? Yeah. I was joking to Bob before. It's one of the things about most of these jobs, the farther away, the easier they look. So we'll leave it at that. But when you go in as a CEO, you have to help people understand, A, you don't know anything, but B, there's a reason why you're coming in at the front of the parade. Because as you move up in your career, as you move up in life, I've always said that when you're promoted or an announcement comes out about your new job, the only one who is excited is you. And and your family. And the best day of the job is the day it's announced. As you get further up in the ranks, the best day of the job, of the new job, is when you're told about it, because no one resents you yet at that point. So, but I'll give you one interesting story, and one thing that was beneficial for me. If these answers are too long,
No. They're here to hear you, not me.
All right.
Although I could go on for a while if you'd like me to.
Here's what was interesting. As I said, I was the first CEO from outside the company. But here's something that very unfortunate that happened to Hershey, but was fortunate for me. And I'll tell you what happened. It was in the fall of 2000, so we're coming up on 6 years ago. It was leaked to the Wall Street Journal that Hershey was going outside for its CEO, which was a big deal for that company. It had never happened before. It was really, you stay there, you work these 10 years, you go to this level, you work these 15 years, you go to this level, and it was very much routinized in that way. I don't say that pejoratively, that's just history has proven that out. So here it was leaked to the Wall Street Journal that the next CEO was going to come from the outside. Well, I hadn't even started talking to the board at that point. So for me, that was beneficial. Think of it from both sides. And for Hershey, it was terrible that was leaked to the outside. But when I got it to the company, I said, you knew you were getting someone, you didn't know who you were getting. And that was very helpful. I think had I, at the time, we don't know, you never know this, at the time, had I been told, you're going to be brought in CEO, no one knows about it, it's going to be a shock, I wonder if I would have thought differently about it, or would have been basically an optimist, the eternal optimist in me would have said, well, sure, I'll be able to deal with that. But that was a very interesting way that got me into Hershey, and it's been a very interesting close to 6 years. And I think Bob may have a couple of questions about that.
How did you make your decision to join Hershey as this was happening? And I know some of the other controversy and even how you entered the town. How did you make the decision? And I'll have one follow up question,
okay,
Rick, which is, how did you assess the organization and the strengths and the weaknesses and what you might need to do? So what was your homework before entering once you made the decision?
Let me answer the second part first, because that's the most illuminating for folks. If you're being interviewed for a CEO or maybe a CFO or president of a group, unlike other jobs, you can't go in and talk to a lot of people. There was a CEO who had announced his retirement, so I was spending time with him. But in terms of talking with any potential members of my executive team, you don't get that opportunity.
Right.
So it's the old expression, it's like bowling with a bedsheet down the alley. You can't see a lot of what you would normally like to understand. And obviously the board of directors, that becomes almost one's lifeline to the opportunity. So there was less ability to speak with people inside the company. And that's one of the greatest outages, because you want to be able to do that. You can read everything you want. You can read analyst reports. You can see what Wall Street says. You can talk to board members. But in terms of trying to get some sense as to the culture, and because there had been very few people that had come to Hershey from the outside, there were very few people outside of Hershey who I might have had experience with at Nabisco or Kraft to spend some time with them. But back to how that kind of turned out. Bob had mentioned that the first 18 years of my career were with Kraft Foods. And you mentioned Bob Eckert. I want to set the record straight on Bob Eckert. His mother carried him for 9 months. I've been carrying him for 30 years. I just want you to
know. Now, Bob is coming to speak, so please
remember that.
To mention that when Bob's up here.
Yeah. Problem is, Bob will say it the other way, so that's it. But so my first 18 years are with Kraft. Now fast forward to Nabisco. In March of 2000, Carl Icahn comes in and makes a run for Nabisco. And now you hear a lot more about activists today than outside of Carl Icahn, you certainly did a few years ago. So Carl Icahn comes and makes a run for the company, so the board of directors has to appropriately go and do the best job possible for all shareholders. Fast forward 6 months, and Kraft buys Nabisco. So I'm back to where I had started a couple of, back to where I had started, but where I had left a few years ago. And I was running one of the big divisions there, but it was also then part of Kraft. And the company had changed quite a bit. I had been gone maybe 5 years at the time. And then this offer or this opportunity at Hershey came along was opportunity to be a chairman and CEO of a publicly traded company, which was not something that I was thinking about every day. But just as you had seen, some of the people I had grown up with in the work world had gone out and become CEOs, and you learned a lot about the opportunities. That's really what got me interested in Hershey. And the personal aspects aside, it was a terrific company in a very attractive category that had great opportunities.
How did the team accept you when you came in, and what were the first things that you did to pull that team together in terms of moving forward?
It was very interesting. I think it was a shock to both of our systems when I walked in there. And I think the fact that I had come from packaged goods companies or food companies that they were well aware of, that they were certainly leadership brands in the categories in which they competed. They understand someone who came from an Nabisco or a Pillsbury or Kraft would have a good understanding about what it takes to build brands and hopefully what it takes to work with customers. And when I got there, it was a very white male leadership team, and that's about what Hershey had been, and we've made some great strides since then. But the most difficult challenge, yet the most important task of any new leader, and so I don't want to just make it CEO, think of it as a president of division or maybe someone who's running a multinational company, but they're doing it for their European business. So anybody who's in a leadership role, the most important thing is you have to assess the team right away and you have to make the changes early on. And that sounds more harsh than it's meant to, but the worst thing that any of us can do is wait 6 months, 9 months to make any type of leadership changes, because a couple of things have happened. You've lost an inordinate amount of time and you have the greatest degrees of freedom early on, but more important than that, the individuals are starting to build either a relationship with you or some false sense of security that, okay, I've made it. And everyone knows when a new leader takes over, there's a couple things have to happen. What's going to happen to the business strategy? You have a little more time with the business strategy. We didn't announce our value-enhancing strategy until October 24th of 2001, so 6 months after we had shown up. And I say we, because shortly after I got there, I was able to attract Dave West is his name. He's now our CFO, who I had worked with at Nabisco. I'd never met him before my years in Nabisco. So after 3 years, here was somebody that I felt would be very beneficial to the company. And so Dave joined me in May. So spending time with the leadership team, helping them understand what, not my philosophy, but helping them understand what I knew about Hershey, which wasn't much, what I needed to know, but more important, that I didn't have the 30 years that some of them had to figure out what to go do. So if any of you have been with a company a long time, you realize all the institutional knowledge that you have and that you bring to the decisions that you make. But if you've just joined a company from outside for a very short amount of time, you don't have that same opportunity to catch up. And so you have to, it's the old expression, 80 for the 20. If you feel you have 80% of it figured out, then you have to move on that. So with the leadership team, I was announced in middle of March of 2001 and then announced a new executive team in early June.
Okay.
So 2 months, let's call it 3 months later or close to it.
One of the things that you and I know that Jim Kilts also, like Rick, was the first outsider at Gillette.
Yes.
To come in a very similar situation. And what Jim did when he first met with the team is there were three things he talked about. He talked about his philosophy. It went off very quickly. His style and his expectations. What did you do when you first got with the team?
I used those same slides that I had written for Jim when he joined us. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. Jim and I, we have very similar business philosophies of very different styles. I think setting, and for those of you who will see the presentation later, I talk about characteristics of an effective Hershey leader. So I talked a little bit about, style's an easy one. I think sometimes it's very, those are weasel words. It is very difficult and not as beneficial to try to tell somebody about your style. It sounds so self-serving, they pick it up very quickly. And the hidden or the silent cues are the most vocal in terms of one style. But I would have started off talking about here's what I believe in terms about the power of the brands, the power being externally oriented, understanding that, and not just because I have a customer in the room, that the customer send us checks, and they were consumers don't, customers pay us. And it was very important for them to, here's one of the little nuance. I was the first CEO that did not come up through the finance side of things. So my background, as Bob had said, is more in, call it marketing, brand management, general management, certainly had never been a CFO, and that was a different orientation. So they're hearing a CEO talking very explicitly about shareholder value is at the end of the equation. That's the end. The means is how do we win in the marketplace, winning by building our brands and enabling customers to be successful in a very attractive category for the retail trade. So it was less about style. It was more about here's what I believe in. Here's how we're going to operate. Almost rules of engagement, for lack of a better term. But I do have pieces of paper, meaning there are, back then it might not have been PowerPoint. It might have just been acetates or flip charts, and go through it, but not so much in a teaching, nothing against that, but in a teaching mannerism, but a way to let them understand, demystify. That's the most important goal early on, is to kind of demystify, because what those folks had done between the time I was announced and the time I showed up, what do you think they did? They called everybody they knew who had ever worked at any of those companies, got the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that was about it. So,
Rick, one of the things that I've asked our students to do, and we've only met one time this quarter, was I asked them to write down their leadership point of view. And at the end of the quarter, we'll see if that's changed a little bit. Can you share a little bit of your leadership point of view, how you lead philosophically as well as on a day-by-day basis?
Yeah, whether the group likes it or not, I would characterize my leadership style as player-coach. And the hard part is that knowing when to steer versus drive. And when business doesn't go that well, we have a tendency to want to drive, meaning, you know, give me the steering wheel. I'm in charge, you know, like the old Al Haig, I'm in charge here. And you have to be careful about that, because that's not really the right way to do it. But it's player coach, less from a controlling perspective and much more because I enjoy business. I enjoy the aspects of building our brands, winning in the marketplace. Yet I spend as much time on the people side of the equation. We have a expression at Hershey, and it's not a slogan, and it's not really a vision or mission statement, but we talk about great people building great brands. And we reinforce broadly throughout the organization that's Hershey's two most valuable assets, our people and our brands. And it's in that order, people before brands. So I'll spend 50% of my time on people issues, but not broad organizational structure, strategic issues, on individual issues in terms of opportunities for people to do things more broadly, people who maybe aren't doing what aren't meeting the expectations that we've set. But in terms of a leadership philosophy or style, it's, I'd say, more collaborative than not. For some reason, over the past 10 years, I've been characterized as a very good listener, and I just don't believe myself to be that way. So I must be one. And it's, you know, it's certainly a recognition that there's a lot more people that have a lot better ideas than I might have. But I'm a firm believer in everybody needs an opportunity to be heard. They also know everybody doesn't have a vote. And at some point, you have to make the decisions. But it's much more a collaborative type of leadership approach. It's much more personal, one-on-one. And the interesting thing is, I'm given opportunities to speak to groups of people at Hershey. And at times, you'll go, oh, man, I don't want to go do that same thing over and over. Until you get there. And you get energized, and someone asks you a question and gives you an opportunity to talk about where the company's headed. So,
there's no question that Hershey's a great brand, recognized all over the world. And you know, you say Hershey, and everybody knows what it is, and the quality of the products that you all have. How do you make sure you have great people? You said great people, great brands. We know, you know, at Kraft that was a given, and we'll chat about that a little bit later. But how do you make sure? Is it selection? Is it development? How do you get great people?
Anybody read the book Good to Great?
Jim Collins.
He's got a great line in there, and it quotes, and I'll paraphrase it a bit. And somebody said something about how do you motivate and discipline people? And he says you don't. You hire self-motivated and self-disciplined people. And that's a very interesting way to think about it, because as adults reach their late 30s or 40s or whatever, some of you in the room, you'll get there. Don't worry, it'll happen. And some of us wish we were there, but it doesn't work that way. It's very difficult to change a person's behavior as we become adults. We always talk about you can mold it a little bit, shape the edges, but you're not going to dramatically change someone who's an introvert to an extrovert, or who is participatory, who must be an individual contributor. I'm not hurting your future livelihood, am I?
No.
But getting those to work well together is the most important thing. It's hiring people, and hiring people who have a like mindset.
What do you do within the company, though, in terms of education, development, and so you're hiring bright, talented people, but then part of it is the development along the way.
Let me give you a good example. We have a senior leadership team of about 42, 43 people. Those are my direct reports and their direct reports, so mostly the vice presidents in the company. Two-thirds of that team are new to their roles, only one half from outside the company. So it was very important when I got there to make sure I didn't say, all right, anyone who's been here, that's no good, and everybody who is good comes from the outside. But we had to create an environment that recognized, rewarded, and fostered that people development is a big deal. So we do a lot of things. I have a senior leaders meeting, not as often as like, almost on a monthly basis with just the top leaders in the company. We have strategic planning courses. We have a leadership development course. We have an executive leadership program that we run in a very intense 5-day period. So anything we do that reinforces the people aspect. We're doing a lot more now, and not nearly as much as we should, cross-group, cross-functional assignments. Here's a quick example. Hershey's a wonderful company, but we're primarily a U.S.-based company. 90% of our business is in the U.S. So getting someone to go work in international has been very difficult. It's been, all right, is there a return ticket? Well, what do you mean I'm going to go to China? We don't have a business in China. Will I ever come back? Now, a lot of companies used to have that, not as much so anymore. But here's what happened. We brought in the head of international, someone who had been with Procter & Gamble's international business for 25 years, and he automatically brought instant credibility that Hershey's serious about international. And so there we're able to move people across groups. I think Bob has done more by giving people the work-related assignment on people development than it is we're going to do something in a very classroom orientation. But one quick aside, one of the most important appointments I made of that leadership team in June of 2001 was the title's now Senior Vice President, Chief People Officer. Her name's Marcella Arline. Marcella had been with the company for 23 years when I had gotten there, 22 years. Never had any HR experience, none. She was Vice President of Quality and Regulatory Compliance, but she had run two of our plants. So she understood people and she understood the culture. Marcella's going to wind up being as much of a change agent for Hershey as anyone we could have brought in from the outside. The worst thing to do is to look to the outside for people to come in and be just the change agents in people development. It will be rejected.
So you work closely with your HR?
Very closely. HR and finance are the two I work with the most closely. They're the connective tissue throughout the company, and that's really it.
You mentioned in the beginning of entering a white male company, which is something we talk about obviously on our campus. What have you done around diversity at Hershey and that whole issue?
We have, and everybody has value statements, and we have 8 core values. And, you know, value statements are great. And I always say, one of ours is openness and candor. And I go, well, no one wakes up and says, all right, I'm going to be open and candid today. One of ours is inclusion. It's, all right, I'm not going to wake up and be inclusive today. And, values are far more aspirational. They're ethereal. And I say, values aren't important until things are going bad. When things aren't going that well, then we truly test our values. But one of our values is inclusion. And we talk a lot about inclusion, that it goes beyond diversity, and diversity has to go beyond the numbers. Everybody believes diversity is the numbers. How many females we have in leadership positions, how many people of color we might have in leadership positions, and what's happened over time, and it's less about that. We talk so much about an inclusive organization being accepting and an acceptance and a willingness to different points points of views and different ways of doing things. And we have a strategic planning course that we teach. It's called KISS. Isn't that cute? KISS? Get it? KISS is KISS.
KISS is Hershey.
It's knowledge and insights for strategic success. And I kick it off. And the one thing I always talk about, there's usually three or four teams. And everybody says, oh, well, team one has a marketing person on it. They're going to do well. No, team two has a finance person on it. They're going to do well. I go, you guys are missing the point. The teams that invariably do the best are the teams that are the most inclusive, that bring their, because everyone starts with the same material, they bring their breadth of experience and background. So for us, it was less about changing the people and more about changing the mindset that, you know what, don't assume accountants are only going to be able to bring an accounting perspective to the business. Don't assume operations people can't bring a brand orientation to the business.
But if we looked at your team today, would it look different than when you entered from the things you initially talked about, from a people of color?
Given how much they all push back, it's a very inclusive team. Yes, it would. It would look very much different.
And that, without asking you numbers,
and that senior leaders team that I talked about, this 42 or 43, is dramatically different in that regard.
Let me shift gears here for a second. One of the topics the last 5 years amongst our students has been the whole issue of integrity and ethics in business. We had the whole Enron, WorldCom, and then came Sarbanes-Oxley. Can you talk a little bit about integrity within the company and also how you all deal with this very expensive change, Sarbanes-Oxley?
Yeah. We think about it. It's very interesting. Here I became the CEO in 2001. You can think about all the things that happened. This one of the slides that I'll show later talks about loss of trust. And it was a trust because of WorldCom, Enron, Tyco. And many of us as CEOs want to lament that it's given CEOs and boards. Now, if you look what's happening with HP, which is just one of the most fascinating experiences, to maybe easy for me to say, right, to watch it from afar. And one can't blame the popular press for the criticism that business overall is getting, and certainly for the position of CEOs. Hershey, to its very credit, for years has had such a high level of integrity.
Yes.
Always. And long before I got there, and long after I got there, that's just part of what it is. Part of it is the geography. Part of it is the background of the culture. And so it was the bigger issue is, as Sarbanes-Oxley came about, there's some very good things within Sarbanes-Oxley, it gave us all a good opportunity to not just review, but make the important changes to controls and procedures. The fact that I sign the Q's and the K's when the financial results come out, you know what, that's interesting, but either I have integrity or I don't, whether I sign it or don't. If you don't have integrity, you're going to sign it anyway. So, I mean, it makes no difference. But if you think about it that way, since when did that get in the way of somebody not doing what's right? And while we all like to talk about you can't legislate integrity and all of that, it does create a new lens by which we look at things. But the most important aspect of that is, if a company has a high level of integrity, if the audit committee, which is all comprised of independent directors, if the audit committee has a direct line to the head of internal audit, which they do within our company, and there's the right procedures in place, you want to make sure the pendulum doesn't swing so far that we are so focused on pure compliance that we lose sight of the fact of, can certainly be compliant, but you still have to be competitive. And we're starting to see that. The cost is one, it was the right cost to bear. Companies want to complain about the cost, but that's a bit of a head fake. It's Sarbanes-Oxley first. It was put in place. We follow it, and it's the right thing to do. We've learned a lot. It won't weed out bad apples if there are bad apples. It will help you find them, but it certainly can't. It can never be a substitute for judgment and the right level of aggressiveness in terms of what it takes to win in the marketplace.
We talked about a little bit about your leadership point of view, and we'll talk some more about that with our students. What do you look for in a leader? What are you looking for as you're hiring people, bringing them into the company, and say, "Yeah, she's got it."
Humility. Right. One of the expressions I use, and everyone hates it, so maybe it strikes a chord. Is there are a lot more smart people than successful people? I'll let that sink in for a minute. And so you certainly want to hire smart people, but there's a lot of smart people. You want to hire smart people who have a great degree of humility, are as quick to discuss and dimensionalize what hasn't worked in their past or where they believe they have an outage as they are to quickly come in. Everybody's got a great resume. You would not put anything in your resume that's not going to be an accomplishment. But remember what I said earlier on, the recognition, there are a lot of others who help you get to that point. And someone, when you're having that discussion, you get the higher the levels, it's a much fit is critically important. But is there a commonality of philosophy? By the time I'm interviewing someone for the head of international or for chief marketing officer position, you pretty much have it figured out whether they've accomplished what their proposed titles might have inferred. And you can, let's say, take chief marketing officer, which is an interesting one. It's easy from a resume and from the marketplace to figure out, did the person really do that? How accomplished are they in that regard? But can they build a team? Can they share your philosophy? Can they come in and provide leadership across the company? As one hires members of an executive team, the role they play in organizational leadership is every bit, if not more important, the role they play in their own functional or business leadership. So it's much broader around philosophy, style to a certain extent, and humility.
Well, Rick and I were talking last night that in the Kraft organization that Rick first joined when he came to Northwestern, this extraordinary group of men and women became CEOs. Irene Rosenfeld just became CEO of Kraft. Yeah. Bob Eckert at Mattel, Doug Conan at Campbell. Oh my gosh.
Marson went to Quaker.
Yeah, a long list of people who've all become senior executives. And one of the original leaders who became chairman of Philip Morris was Mike Miles. And I was interviewing Mike Miles recently, and to what Rick said, I asked him, you know, how did you develop all these people? And his comment was, I hire really smart people who are not jerks. It took me off guard to use some other colorful language, which I'll not use. And Mike is a brilliant, brilliant leader. But what he was basically saying to me is the same thing Rick was just saying. I really want good people, you know, with values. And obviously that worked at Kraft. How are you carrying that forward at Hershey today?
At Hershey, when I got there, one would have been hard pressed to found anybody to characterize him as a jerk.
As a jerk, yeah.
It just wasn't in the culture. So when I was looking to bring people in from the outside, if there were people that I had worked with, then there'd be more commonality. Dave West is one that I mentioned. Chris Baldwin joined us a couple of years ago. Chris is president of our U.S. commercial group. Tom Hernquist is our global growth and innovation head, and we worked at Nabisco. And so that's an easier one, a commonality. But take someone such as J.P. Bilbrey, the head of international, who came from Procter, that it was very much how will he be received, and recognizing you want people to come in and help change the direction of the company, but you don't want people coming in and just for the sake of change being disruptive. They're not going to be successful. The company's not going to be successful. And so it's really looking for those similar types of, not style so much, because the style's very different across the executive team, but very much a common set of values and a recognition that the people side of the equation is every bit as important as the business side.
Thanks, Rick. Let's talk a little bit about communications within Hershey, which is with 13,000 associates scattered around the U.S. and now internationally. How do you stay connected? How do you communicate with people at the furthest remote? I'm sensitive when I say lowest level, but entry level in the organization. How do they find out from you, you know, where the company's going, and how do you stay connected with where they all are?
I'll get to that. How many of you have heard of the Gallup survey? There's a Gallup, 12 questions,
12 questions,
12 questions are terrific. I've used those for years, and there's one question that that everybody hates.
Do you have a best friend?
Do you have a best friend at work? And everybody says, I don't want a best friend at work. My wife is my best friend, or my husband if it's a woman, or whatever. And we go, you're missing the point of the best friend. The best friend means someone at work you can shut the door, or you can go have a cup of coffee or have lunch with and say, I've really got an issue, or can you help me with this? And there's no fear of reprisal or no fear that an individual's going to use that for his or her own betterment. So I love the 12 questions, but the two things that come out of a Gallup survey, no matter where you work, are lack of confidence in senior management and poor communications. No matter how much one... I didn't say that was from Hershey. I'm just saying that's just a generic one. I always love when people talk about it when they say, well, you know, the survey said, it's like that old Family Feud. No, the survey said there's a lack of confidence in senior management. I said, who do you think that means? And they go, well, it's you guys. And I said, yeah, it's always senior management is always someone above you when things don't go well. here's the deal about communication. You can never communicate enough, but then you run the risk of over-communicating. And we have to be very mindful. I always tell folks, I'll tell you 95% of what I know. There's some, particularly in a chairman and CEO of a publicly traded company, there's a fiduciary responsibility. You can't share all of it. But there is so much a desire to understand what are we doing, why we're doing, and demystify the rumor mill. Nature abhors a vacuum. And anytime you leave dead space, it will be in an organization, it will be filled by things that are invariably incorrect. How many of you, I can't believe I'm asking this one, how many of you read the Yahoo message board? Don't raise your hand if you do. And people will read about blank company. They go, well, I read on the Yahoo message board that blank, blank, and blank. I said, well, please don't read that. And so not about Hershey. I have employee breakfasts. Marcel and I have employee breakfasts once a month, and I love it because it's the people from all over the company, and they ask me you can always ask any question you want as long as it's done in a polite manner. We have quarterly town hall meetings. We release our quarterly results. Typically, it's the third week of the month following the quarter, and ours is October 19th next week. We have a town hall that afternoon. I do a dear colleague letter. I do the senior leaders meetings. I spend a lot of time traveling to plants and sales offices, and that's where I get to see people locally. And that's really it. It's not that I have a little chart that I says, okay, it's week 3, day 4, go do this. It's not that routinized. But invariably, self-critical.
Yeah.
Invariably, I don't do it nearly as much as I would like. And if you don't do it, everyone says, why are they gone underground? You know, something's wrong. We haven't seen so-and-so. And you have to be mindful about that.
Rick, what's the most challenging issues facing you today as a CEO of a publicly traded company, a growing company, again, a company with tremendous issue, history, I'm skewing that issue. What keeps you up at night? What are you most concerned about?
I'm asked that question more than anyone, what keeps me up at night, and I invariably say everything, because that's typically what happens. And the only thing I'm terribly worried about is my wife and daughter's well-being, so it's as simple as that. From a business standpoint, I am very concerned about how rapidly within consumer products goods, within what we do for a living, the adoption and disposal of new items. Let me be a little bit more explicit. It used to be innovation was one. The innovation curve took a long time to reach the peak, and then it took a long time to decline from that. We all want to invent the next Swiffer, the next iPod. Take a step back. The next Lunchables. Those are very, very few and far between. So I'm very concerned from a pure business standpoint. I'll get to the people side in a second. Mm-hmm. From a business standpoint, the new product life cycle is the shortest I've seen it in close to 30 years. And so we're running rapidly to try to bring innovation to the marketplace. And what we think is innovative, all of you as consumers view as just another variety. And I'm very concerned about as elastic as we believe our brand equities and brand franchises are, they're not nearly as elastic as we think, and so we have to be mindful. And we're seeing it within our company. We're becoming much more platform-driven in terms of dark chocolate, refreshment, some of the other platforms that we think are sustainable. So from a business standpoint, it's that. From a Hershey standpoint, what's the right way for us to become a global company? Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, we have about 10% of our business from outside of the U.S., and that pales in comparison to our major competitors. We don't just compete, bless you, we don't just compete with a Mars or a Nestle in the U.S., because if we're trying to get merchandising space within grocery outlet, if we're trying to get merchandising space within, just
guys?
To name one.
Yeah,
that's right. Within Longs Drugs or within a Safeway, we're not just competing with Mars and Nestle. We're competing with Pepsi. We're competing with Kraft. We're competing with Kellogg. Now, that's in the U.S. But broadly, if we want to be smart about what it takes to win in China or India or Brazil, three markets that we're starting to do some work in, it's very difficult to almost come from a standing start. So we're looking at what's the right partnerships to have in those parts of the world. So from a business standpoint, it's how fleeting innovation is, or what we believe to be innovation, is nothing more than variety.
Right.
How do we take this company global and do it in, make it global and do it in a way that doesn't deleverage our scale in the U.S.? We have the leadership position, the largest, most profitable chocolate market in the world in the U.S. We are never going to abandon that leadership week in and week out. Our goal is to build that leadership, but then how do we expand outside of it? And from the other one that, if I stayed at night about
Please.
Work, on the people side, is are we challenging our people enough? Are we giving them enough opportunities? Are we helping them recognize that day in and day out it is a drudgery? You say, well, you're the CEO, or Hernquist is a global growth officer. It is a drudgery because it's the mind-numbing day in and day out execution, getting the basics right, that determines whether we're successful or not. I mean, I've never seen a strategy fail in a boardroom. You know, you put PowerPoint slides, they never fail. Of course they don't. You wouldn't be in there presenting it. But it's the execution. And so how do we get 13,000 people? Think of it as a to-do list. How do we get the same to-do list on 13,000 people? It is very, very difficult. So keeping people motivated and engaged, and it can't always be everything's wonderful. But people are very resilient. Everybody wants to know, as an individual, I hope you want to know, where am I doing well? What opportunities am I missing? Where's my future in this company? And if not, we have to be very direct about helping people understand this isn't the best place for them.
You talked about innovation, so that means you didn't invent Lunchables like everybody.
I'm the only one who doesn't claim fame to Lunchables. Yeah. So
we're just a kind of a fun.
We have Kissables. That's kind of close.
We have multiple. Kraft owned Oscar Mayer, and it's where Lunchables came from. And there are lots of our friends that all claim that they invented Lunchables. So,
Can I give one interesting business philosophy on Lunchables? Everybody know what Lunchables is, and it seems almost quaint now, but 15 years ago was a huge breakthrough. But the breakthrough was within Oscar Mayer's culture.
Trino.
Because Oscar Mayer, their philosophy was, we want to produce sliced meat at the speed of light. What do you mean we have to spend money to hand assemble? And packaging and labor is going to cost more than the ingredients. But it was the huge breakthrough because it was a market-facing opportunity to bring convenience and more healthful type of convenience. If meat and cheese for kids isn't that bad for lunch. And the breakthrough was within the culture to do it. Not so much that it was a great marketing idea. And that's when a company can do that, when a company can look externally, grab a consumer insight, yet get inside a company, change the way by which they were doing it. It's like taking a company and going from vertical to horizontal. It's amazing. And that's the true story behind Lunchables.
This would be a fun story. That's a whole book about that.
Yes.
I'll ask a couple more questions, and then I'd love to let you all. Okay. Thank you, Becky. One question that always gets asked, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about it, is, you know, how do you keep your life balanced and your family and as much as you travel and as busy as you are? What do you do to take care of the personal side of your life?
There's no balance. Forget it. There's no balance. I will sleep when I retire. I will take vacations when I retire. That's true. Exercise. I exercise almost every day, and that's not so I can eat as much chocolate as I would like. It's all part of a well-balanced diet. You know that, and it's for my mental health as much as my physical health. That's a good way for balance. These jobs, and you said everybody who works, you understand it. They require a lot of energy, and it's physical energy. And if you have physical energy, you have mental acuity, and that is very important. My wife Susan, as Bob mentioned, we met at Kraft years and years ago. She was in brand management, so Susan kind of gets the deal. And our daughter Sarah just, you know, knows that Dad's never home, but her closest next parent type is Bob Eckert, and she knows that Bob's never home. So it works out when your friends kind of do what you do. So,
do you ever think about retirement? What does that mean to you?
Depends on how business is. I think the board probably thinks about it. No, I think we've all read that what was viewed as retirement, maybe even as recent as 10 years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, the picture of that's a lot different. I think about what I might do next. I can't imagine just stopping being involved in work. As much pressure as we think we have, and most of it is self-imposed, and the pace, a lot of that is self-imposed. You can't slow down the merry-go-round. Certainly I don't yet want to experience is what happens when you get off the merry-go-round. You don't have any idea what that experience is going to be like because you're so used to it going at such a speed that you have no idea what it's like. So I haven't thought that much about it.
Is there a succession plan for you at Hershey?
Yes. Two things we do with our board on an annual basis. We do them both, but it's in June at our board retreat, is we do a full assessment of the strategic plan. And it's a very good time to figure out, is the plan working, what's not working? And we don't just put it on the shelf for a year. We go back and refer to it through the course of the year. That's a good time to get the board's input. But equally as important on the people side is we do succession planning. And a very detailed, comprehensive succession planning process. It's a great discussion because that's the board's number one job, is to ensure the right succession and the right development for the CEO and the executive team.
Well, I could ask Rick a million questions. This is just fun for me to go back and forth with them. I want to give you all a chance to ask a couple of questions. Becky's got a microphone. Eric, I'll let you take the first question.
Anything is fair game.
The foundation relationship when you took over, the conflict that ensued, how did that resolve, and how is that relationship now?
Good question. I'll try to give you the short version, and you can go back to the newspapers of 2002 and see if my revisionist history is correct at this point. The Hershey Trust, which was set up by Milton Hershey many years ago, they are the controlling shareholder for the Hershey Company. We're publicly traded, Delaware Incorporated. The Hershey Trust, by virtue of Class A and Class B shares, which I won't get into, but it's important for this part of it, they have a 33% economic interest, but a 77% voting interest because their Class B shares have more votes than Class A shares. In 2002, and it was widely chronicled that the trust, and I was not on the trust board at the time, I went on the trust board after this situation occurred, the trust board, for a lot of reasons, decided they wanted to monetize the asset, and they put the trust put the Hershey Company up for sale. Interestingly, I was informed of that in March of 2002. In April of 2002, the longest strike in the history of the company occurred. So here I am, a year in my job, and I'm presiding over, that's my claim to fame, I presided over the longest strike in the history of the company and the aborted sale of the company. So no matter whatever is written about me, those are the two things, at least from a Hershey perspective. And we spent the next 6 months going through that process. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, I have been involved in the process of selling a company before. It happened at Nabisco. Ironically, it happened at Kraft in 88 when Philip Morris bought Kraft. So it's very interesting to have gone through that. And my favorite expression is the only time you want to be a seller is of a used car. So that's, you'd rather be on the buying side of things. And so we had, at the time, we had brought, and we needed, here's one thing that's important. As a publicly traded company, despite the fact the trust has the voting control at 77%, what the Hershey board had to do was act in the best interest of all shareholders. Because if any of you were a shareholder of that 67% economic, and the trust, the majority shareholder, put the company up for sale, all you care about is, as a shareholder, am I maximizing my investment? So we had to do everything possible, whether it was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. And we were opposed to it at the time because we were just getting started with our strategic plan. And long the short of it is, there was an offer made from Wrigley. It was a very attractive premium. The trust turned it down at that time. So then it was, all right, I guess we go back to work. And at the time, what the price, and we've split our shares since then, the price was $89 a share, and we were trading at about $62 at the time. And I remember telling our employees, we now know the price is $89. We need to get there the old-fashioned way, through fundamentals, and we ultimately did. Because $89 pre-split is $45 post-split, and we're trading about $52 or $53 today. So that was a very, very interesting time. And talk about being in a position where you had never gone through it before as the CEO, be what you think inherently ill-prepared, but all your experience comes to bear, and hopefully you go through it in the right way. And there's I love the expression that I heard from somebody where it says, what do you do when you're going through hell? Keep going. And it was, and it's a great saying, and it's one that, and I could talk for hours on that, because the opportunities to engage with the board and provide leadership of the board, go through it with the company, provide leadership around what the employees thought you were concerned about, the strike, because the sale didn't become public till July. So from March to July, we were working on this sale process, yet from April to June, we had the strike. I had plenty of dark hair at the time. I was well over 6 feet tall at the time. Both those experiences, when I talk about leadership, one of the things I always talk to folks about, characteristic of leadership, is a willingness and a desire to put oneself in uncomfortable and unfamiliar positions. And that's where our strengths are leveraged, and we learn and grow the most. And those were two that were really both unfamiliar and uncomfortable at the time. So thank you for that.
Other questions, please.
Organic food, what's your opinion?
Real quickly on organics, the fastest growing organic segment is milk. The most commoditized category in a grocery store is milk, yet consumers recognize the price-value relationship within organics. And I hope its growth is done correctly, where we don't get the head fakes, well, it's partially organic, or it's made from organic ingredients, or it was packaged by someone who read a book on organics. We have to be careful that it is truly organic, and the USDA seal is very important, but the activist groups will be far more keen on those who violate what we all agree is organic, or the principles to be organic. So it's
thanks,
one
Pam.
Very
important. Robert, you're up. I'm sorry. I apologize.
We'd like to thank you so much for coming, and we'd like to thank both of our speakers. And what's going to happen now is some of us are going to go, and then the class will stay. So if you notice people hanging around, that's what's happening.
Please.
We have a gift for you from the Graduate School of Management. And again, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.